From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. We hope this episode finds you healthy and happy and maybe amid grand adventure, perhaps even out on the ocean. Now that so many countries are relaxing a lot of their formerly draconian lockdown policies, today we'd like to explore the ocean along with you, in a way. The ocean is fascinating. We know less about what goes on in the ocean now than we do about what goes on the surface of the moon. And, you know, very few people have been to the moon. A lot of people have been on the surface of the ocean, and a lot of people have gone to the bottom, but far fewer people have returned to the top.
And one quick thing about that, as we've just been learning and as was announced by NASA today, I believe, we are sending a new little rover up to the moon called the Viper that's supposed to be landing on the moon and going around and looking for water in 2023, which is pretty interesting.
I believe that's all. That kind of mission is also at least partially intended to be a proving ground for later searches on Mars. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Does it come equipped with a little divining rod that just like kind of vibrates when it hits water? It just kind of like sniffs around for it?
Yeah, it's more high tech. Four wheels and then a small protruding
divining rod. Just like spring loaded. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question because it goes into the concept of vibration and sound, which is what, all sound is vibration. And going back to the ocean, the biggest source of water that we are experientially familiar with as a species, we know that it is just like the surface of the planet. It's riotous with life. The thing is that the creatures in the ocean, wherever they are in the ocean or these seas of ours, they live a vastly different existence. In some cases, it's almost alien. Like we've often heard it said that cephalopods, especially the super intelligent ones like octopuses, are the closest our species has to, you know, an example of what alien life would look like. And it's fascinating stuff, but it's also so obscured to us. It's occulted. We don't know what is happening in the ocean.
Oh, I know. And if you want to get a look at that, I really recommend the, I think it's called Blue Planet, or no, Planet Earth, maybe. There's an episode about the deep, 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 like Marianas Trench deep ocean creatures. And they look like aliens, like the angler fish with the little light bulb thing on their heads, and then this one called the vampire squid that looks literally like something straight out of the gates of hell. But the adaptations that happen at those depths with such little light are absolutely fascinating. And like you say, Ben, the closest thing to alien life that I think we're going to be able to ever set our eyes on in our lifetime.
At least officially, right?
And
the thing is that because unfortunately, because the vast majority of human exploration, invention, and ingenuity depends on, you know, the concept of a monetary economy, by far the most popular religious belief of our age, we find ourselves in a position where, as a species, we can get down to incredible depths in the ocean, but we have to propitiate to the economic gods first. Look, pretentiousness aside, it's very, very expensive to explore the ocean, is what we're saying. And people have always been in this push-pull over whether or not it's a good investment to explore the ocean. Militaries are one of the most powerful, well, forget one of. Militaries are the most powerful human force on or below the surface of the ocean. And because it is so difficult and so expensive to get actual people down past a certain depth for any substantial length of time, we have built tools to tell us what's going on. We've built this kind of synthetic mimicry of a natural thing that existed way before humans actually existed. We invented something called sonar. It's turned every ship into the Marvel comic book hero Daredevil. Here are the facts.
That's a really good way to put it. That's exactly what sonar does. It's also called, or is called, stands for sound navigation and ranging. And it's extremely common. It's used in almost every vessel that is large enough to travel around for any reason on the ocean. And just like you said, like Daredevil, it allows us to see without visualizing. It's using sound to essentially visualize what exists both in the depths and out in front of you, and basically in 360 degrees around you within the water. And it really is fascinating that we were able to figure out how this works, just humanity in general. And it's cool how it mimics natural processes that a lot of other animals do.
Yeah, and it's an old technology. It's much older than you might think. A lot of people who are perhaps in the younger demographic of our fellow listeners may understandably think sonar is something that came about after, what would you say, guys, World War II, maybe?
Yeah, it seems kind of techie. I mean, it almost has like a futuristic vibe when you think about, you know, the readout and the way it looks like on a submarine or a naval vessel with like the grid and like, you know, sending out the pings and being able to recreate, you know, map topography underwater using sound. That sounds pretty kind of brave new worldy and futuristic. But we also have to remember that this is a quote unquote technology that exists in the natural world and that we're kind of just mimicking, that we've sort of hijacked from, you know, organic beings like whales and dolphins.
No, you're absolutely right. So you can imagine how, let's say, someone studying animals, bats even, or anyone else that's any other animal that's using echolocation, but perhaps specifically an animal that's using sound within the water, within the ocean, to either communicate or to figure out where it is and what's, you know, what dangers lurk ahead. So you imagine that studying animals, someone in 1822 created sonar. Like, imagine that. There's at least the precedent, the thing that existed that became sonar. There was a gentleman named Daniel Culloden. He stuck a bell underwater, and he was using this to calculate the speed of sound as it's traveling through water rather than air. Like, if you, it's very, very different, and it does travel very differently. So That occurred way back in 1822. Then you do have to fast forward a little bit further to 1906, when modern sonar, as we generally understand it, exists today. There's a guy named Lewis Nixon who built what we would consider to be a sonar-like device, and it was specifically made to detect icebergs.
Yeah, and so was that, this is a silly question, and I'm not meaning to sound flippant, but was that technology around when the Titanic got iceberg headed, you know, would they have just had visual on that, or like that would have been in the late 1800s? No, that's not true.
No, it was after 1906. It was after the Lewis Nixon invention, but
it's a shame.
This is widespread, and that's a, we could call it modern sonar, but modern sonar is really galvanized by war, like so many other great technological breakthroughs. It happens as a way for people to figure out how to kill more people or to figure out how to keep more people from killing them.
You could kind of imagine it, Ben. Like, oh, all right, Nixon, so this thing can detect icebergs, right? Well, can it detect, you know, name the adversary? Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Did it detect Germans?
And you know, submarines, of course, are an episode all their own in the modern day. They're fascinating things. In World War II, they were horrible places to be. And in World War I, that was even more true. But these things could be, you know, the concern about what submarines would become in World War II really triggered this research in sonar. And sonar, you know, not to belabor the point, sonar works in a pretty straightforward way. The way we can understand it at a high level without getting into too much of the physics here is that it emits sound waves. Bing, bing, bing. And it measures how long the echo of those sound waves takes to return after it hits something. That means, for example, if we're all on the Conspiracy cruise, that's spelled S-E-A, and we are using sonar in shallow water, then our pings are going to return to us more quickly because they are traveling a shorter distance. But if we're over a very deep part of the water, then it's going to take longer for those sound waves to return. And this is common knowledge. It's how bats work. It's how Daredevil works. There's nothing particularly scary about it yet. There are two types of sonar, though. The first one is kind of what we described, active sonar. Makes the sound, makes the ping, waits for the ping, and then you're like, oh, okay, there we are. In general, the longer distance stuff is going to use much lower frequencies, and we'll probably have some onomatopoeia here in today's episode, but the lowest long-distance active sonar kind of makes this like this boom sound, and it's valuable. Boats, ships need this. We use sonar for a lot of stuff, but there's another one you need to know about, and that is passive sonar.
Yeah, passive sonar listens, but doesn't transmit. And these are often used by militaries, but scientific research uses these systems as well for entirely different applications. Passive sonar systems usually have large databases of sonic information that they collect. A computer system can use these databases to identify different classes of ships or types of actions they might be taking, like speed or a particular type of weapon that they're releasing. And even, you know, the make and model of the ship. Sonar is also a super valuable tool for, like we said earlier, creating kind of recreating topography of underwater landscapes, nautical charts and maps, locating various underwater hazards, mapping of the seafloor, looking for shipwrecks, or, you know, let's just take it a step further just because we're all dreamers here. Let's call it buried treasure. And today it's used over more than 70% of the world's oceans. So, like we sort of teased earlier, this is not something that man just invented out of whole cloth. This is something that whales use as well, and other underwater creatures. Whales in particular use it to know how to move around, to how to make sure they're not running into any icebergs or battleships or what have you, or just any kind of obstacles. Now, they're large creatures and fascinating ones to boot, even more fascinating than the whole concept we're talking about here, which is sonar. A lot of folks out there in podcast land are probably going to be surprised to learn just how much we do not understand about whales in this, the year 2020.
Yeah. Yeah. We are embarrassingly, cartoonishly clueless about a lot of aspects of whales in general. I want to separate a couple things. When we talk about whales and sonar, we have to remember, first off, that there are quite a few different types of whales. Often, I think, when we hear whales, just the term, we think of the largest whale, right? The blue whale. That is what's called a baleen whale. They've got those weird plates. They swim through the ocean. They just digest a bunch of very small things. That's
stuff just funnels in.
Yeah, that's just their bag. They stuck with it. They're very good at it, and they're huge. And then there are toothed whales. A dolphin is like an example of a toothed whale. These are the ones that use echolocation to move around the ocean. And echolocation, like we said earlier, it's the natural world's predecessor to sonar. Whales have what you could call a language. There's a lot of research that's gone into the language of different whales, the ideas of the songs and so on. So for whales that are using echolocation, they're communicating in high whistles, impulse bursts of sounds, and then clicks. And this is interesting. This is something I did not know. The clicks made by toothed whales are the loudest sounds made by any marine mammal, which means that once upon a time, before the age of the Anthropocene, they were the loudest regular sounds in the ocean. And it sounds hyperbolic, but it is insane. Like they can use this, they can use these things in a weaponized way too. They're mapping the seafloor as they swim. They're mapping underwater obstacles, like you said, Matt, depth of water, shorelines, figuring out where other animals are. And then there's this theory that's pretty new that says maybe some of their high intensity focused sounds are almost like the weapons in Dune. Maybe they're stunning or disorienting prey. Maybe they're attacking with sound. I mean, that's pretty crazy, and the science is pretty compelling. It's also a very sensitive trait. That's why, you know, we see that animals tend to have a primary sense, sort of a lead singer in the band of their senses. For humans, we're a visual creature, right? We have taste and smell and sound and stuff, and they're all very important, but we like to see stuff. And for many of these animals, their protagonist in their gang of senses, the leader of their sensory heist crew, is sound, is this echolocation, which makes sense because you can't see very well at certain depths of the ocean, right? It's more difficult. And so, of course, it's going to be those instruments on their bodies are going to be more sensitive, the same way that dogs are primarily olfactory creatures. They live by their sense of smell. That's why if you don't want to be a jerk, don't bop a dog or a cat on the nose. They will be infuriated with you.
That's a really interesting thing to talk about there, Ben, just about how sensitive the sensors are on them, on toothed whales, but also just the different uses of sounds that they emanate. And, you know, we're talking about those clicks and being able to almost weaponize them as like an audio flashbang or something to be able to use like that. They've also got sounds, and not just toothed whales. You can also think about a couple other different kinds, gray whales, bowhead whales. They have behaviors that are considered to be avoidance behaviors or like escape behaviors. And the sounds that they can emanate when essentially distressed are extremely loud. And some of the other louder things that would have existed in the ocean. Just again, fascinating creatures. We have a ton to learn. And you know, we're talking mostly about toothed whales here, but if you go back to the baleen whales, it's not as though they're just silently trawling the waters and going around. These are the animals that you would hear if you've ever heard anyone talk about a whale song, or if you've heard any recordings, perhaps, of something that would be called a whale song. These whales do make a lot of sounds, and they communicate through these sounds with each other. And again, it's the same kind of thing we would talk about. Where is the food? Where are we going? Where are you? Here I am. At least that's our current understanding. And we can only assume that it gets much, much more complicated than that. We just don't have a way to translate yet.
We do know that there are dialogue or accent differences in different groups of certain whales. We know that some of these communications seem intergenerational, right? That they are taught to their young. There's also a heartbreaking story of a one tone deaf whale that was excluded from its community. But We'll leave that heartbreak to you to find, dear listener, fellow conspiracy realist. Noel, I think you said you found a pretty good onomatopoeic description of what a whale song is like written out. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable to see it on paper, and then I tried to pronounce it out for you guys off mic. I'm going to give it another shot here. I'm not going to do an impression of a whale. I'm just going to kind of do it like a human reading onomatopoeia. It's something along the lines of blur-ga-roo-wa-wa-wa.
That was beautiful.
You can also find recordings, of course, of whale songs, I believe, from different years, different parts of the ocean. We're very well aware of this. There is not at this point, is one of the questions I would ask if I were hearing this for the first time. There's not at this point what we would understand as a good translation, right? There's not. There have been attempts to communicate with whales through technological means. But right now, sadly enough, one of the most effective ways that humans have communicated with whales is through sonar. We have to talk about how these processes interact. Okay, so we understand echolocation. We understand sonar, right? We've got the basics. So two thought experiments. Imagine you're walking in a dim, gigantic room. You're trying to find your way to the door, to an egress. All of a sudden, thousands of laser lights are shining into your eyes, or thousands of flashlights. What they're doing is whomever is using those lights is illuminating the room for themselves, but they are blinding you in the process. That's part of the reason that police in intimidation tactics will make sure to keep a light on your eyes. It puts the person getting the light shown on them at a tremendous disadvantage. It's a very similar thing with whales. Or since we're talking about sound, right, rather than talking about sight, imagine that you're hanging out with the four of us at an Applebee's. I say the four of us because Paul is, of course, there too.
Oh, to be in an Applebee's right now.
The apps, right? And we're having a chat, you know, maybe maybe Matt is going up to, I don't know, do something important. We'll write the script later. And then, Noel, you're going to say something to him like, hey, don't forget the, make that two margaritas or something. But right as Noel's going to say that, somebody we don't know, maybe never will meet again, burst into the lobby and they blast sound, so much sound that it's like when you can feel the bass in your bones times 20. Forget trying to tell Matt about that margarita. Our eardrums are bleeding. We're starting to lose consciousness. And then when the sound passes, we are damaged.
Yeah, I mean, any crossover listeners to Ridiculous History will remember an episode we did with a preeminent expert on underwater explosions named Dr. Rachel Lance, and we talk about the sinking of the Hunley, which is a super rudimentary Civil War submarine, which I didn't even know was a thing, but it's like basically like a Flintstones car submarine that you crank with your feet. Really, really dangerous. Every time they did a test run of it, people died, and then it actually did sink a warship. But Dr. Lance, her area of expertise was talking about the way these underwater shockwaves affect our bodies and our internal organs, and they can cause serious internal damage to our viscera. And that's kind of what we're talking about here, right?
Yeah. And with those two ideas, this at the very least complicates things. So that's our question today. What is happening here? What's happening under the surface of the ocean, and how are you complicit? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy. Sonar is massively... Paul, please edit me here. We have to say it. Sonar is massively f***ing up whales. People knew about it before the public did, and even when it was open secret, the militaries of the world, which were, and you know, shipping interests, did some stuff that was similar to the actions of oil companies when they knew about climate change. It kind of fought against this, right? And they did it for they did it pretty successfully. And they did it for what they would see as compelling reasons, what they would see as, once again, one of the great boogeymen of history, the greater good. So what happened?
So if we go back to the early 1900s, when we would consider that era to be the beginning of sonar, let's say, you know, around World War I, really, then we would have to go much further. We're talking 60-something years to get to around 1971, which is what we would say is the beginning of academic concerns about what sonar is doing to wildlife, the effects that it's having on whales and other creatures and animals in the ocean. And there were two men that were looking into this, Roger Payne and Douglas Webb. They went on to prove that before humans had ships, small ships, large ships, massive ships, just go traveling across the ocean and within the ocean, before we were doing that, the tones from creatures called fin whales, so it's a specific type of whale, the tones that they were generating in the processes we've talked about prior to this, they could travel as far as 4,000 miles within the ocean and still be discernible against just the ambient general background noise that exists when you're in the ocean. 4,000 miles, the approximate distance of the Amazon River. From the beginning, from the mouth to the end.
So they could say, what up? I'm a cool whale from the mouth of the Amazon River looking for a cool whalette to hang out with. And then even if they were on the very far end of the Amazon River, 4,000 miles away, these other whales could hear them.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Terrible example.
Well, I mean, it's pretty close to the internet when you think about just how large the ocean is and how far away that is if you're talking about 4,000 miles in every direction.
Yeah, that's a good point, Matt. A lot of people don't realize that. The internet is 4,000 miles long. That is a hard limit that has been put into place. We did not make the rules. We just want to arm you with the information. But there's another stat there that is I think even more amazing. I mean, you mentioned background noise, right? The ocean is like, if you've ever been in a forest when nothing bad is happening, then you realize that it is cacophonous. You know, there's so much noise going on. And if you don't hear a lot of noise, it's either because you're there or because something worse than you is there. So be careful. And it's amazing when you think about it.
If you look at what the Animal Welfare Institute, as well as the NOAA and a couple other organizations, at least what they have on their websites, what they say, the research is, and this isn't completely accurate, but you can look a little further into this if you wish, but the relative sound level and intensity per decibels of ambient ocean noise levels are, it's a range from around 55 to 85 decibels just as a standing. And if you compare that to what the effective levels of LFA sonar are, that's around 230 and higher decibels. So just if you can go ahead and imagine that that's what we're talking about here.
I mean, that I think is a stunning difference there. It also reminds me that we know that in the days before propeller-driven watercraft, which obviously predates sonar, these whale noises and sounds could travel even further. They were even louder because, you know, of course, these propellers make noise pollution as well. The whales in the era, the halcyon days of pre-propeller ocean, they could make sounds that would travel 13,000 miles. That's an estimate. And the reason it's an estimate is because that's more than the diameter of Earth. So imagine being able to communicate so well. If you're, you know, we're whales, we're swimming around and we yell, hey, then later behind us, we hear ourselves saying, hey. I mean, that's not going to happen because there are a lot of obstacles and land and stuff. But if there were an uninterrupted sphere, that would be possible. It's crazy. It's the shot heard around the world probably came from a whale instead of a person.
It does make you think that maybe creatures that exist in the water, just, you know, as it is a water planet, were the ones that were meant to be the intelligent species that evolved. That's going to take me down a rabbit hole for another time.
It's like the old Mitchell and Webb sketch, you know, where these two Nazis are looking at each other, and one of them goes, "Are we the baddies? Like, are we the bad guys?"
There's a skull on your hat.
right. So we know that there, just like there are different types of whales, just like there are different types of ships, there are different types of sonar. So maybe let's talk a little bit about something called mid-frequency sonar. There's been research on this. You know, think of low frequency, high frequency, mid-frequency. It's the Goldilocks of sonar.
It's not to be confused with like mid-century sonar, which is very clean lines and, you know, really aesthetically pleasing, but not particularly comfortable. Okay, that was a bad dad joke, but I'm furnishing my new house, so that's where my mind is at right now. But there was evidence of something called mid-frequency sonar and how it affects whales back as far as the 90s, which compared to the invention of sonar itself is pretty recent. In fact, whalers are the ones who actually figured it out and used it to the detriment of these giant and majestic creatures. In Among Whales by Roger Payne, who we mentioned earlier, he notes that whalers figured out that a frequency of 3,000 hertz sent whales into like panic mode. It caused them just to freak out and to surface for air, maybe when they didn't even need it, because the stress probably robbed them of oxygen, or they were breathing more rapidly, and so they would come up to the surface more often, and this allowed them more opportunities to shoot them. So they had these essentially sonar weapons on their boats that they would use to you know, deploy that frequency into the water and reap the rewards.
Yeah, it was less useful. It was designed to help them track whales, but as soon as they found that sweet spot frequency, the real reason they would use it, their primary reason, became just what you're saying, Noel. Make the whales do something called panting. So when they panic, they release air. And you know, like you said, they can stay underwater a long time as long as they have the air stored up. And they had to surface, and then the whalers would get them. So at least some members of humanity figured out there were ways that sonar clearly affected whales. But it goes beyond that. Aside from sonar being used by whalers, which is an example I wish more people knew, and aside from it obviously hampering communication in the gigantic Applebee's of the ocean, how else does it affect these creatures? The answer is something we've all heard of. We've all seen pictures of it. It's called beaching.
Yes. In 1996, a man named Alexandros Francis proved that 12 Cuvier's beaked whales beached themselves. They beached themselves alive. It wasn't as though they were deceased and then washed up. They swam ashore. They did that along the coast of Greece. According to Alexandros, these whales did that while NATO was testing an active sonar system, and they were using two different kinds that we've already talked about, both mid-range and low-frequency transducers. He essentially just kind of was able to, in 1996, Alexandros Francis, to point to it and say, hey, look at these beached whales. There's 12 of them. They were beached when this sonar system was being tested, to actually point to it, not maybe for the first time, but to really show it. And the article was published, get this, 2 years after this occurred in Nature Magazine in 1998.
I like that you differentiated in Nature Magazine.
Yes. Well,
exactly. And it did a fine job of proving a link, establishing a link between these mass beachings of whales and the use of military grade sonar. In order to do that, they concluded that although, you know, you can't completely rule out pure coincidence, there was greater than a 99.3% chance that sonar testing caused that that situation. And the idea that a low power sonar could, keep in mind, this was not operating at full capacity, a low power sonar could cause this level of chaos was really disturbing, and pointed to how dangerous this technology could actually be within these populations of whales. And at by that point, most of the research has been focused on the possibility of figuring out a way to maybe soften these signals or mask them in some way. Because it's, you know, it's obviously like, it's not like they're in, you know, the whalers were using the sonar to actually mess with the whales, but the military grade sonar isn't intended to hurt whales. It's just sort of an unfortunate byproduct, like birds getting caught in wind turbines and the like. So they were looking into some possibilities of masking them to prevent situations like this, also to prevent interference with things like mating calls and other, you know, functional uses of sonar by whales, like avoiding giant obstructions, not crashing into seawalls or whatever you want to call that.
I just want to reiterate here before we continue forward that you said it there, Noel, but we've known about what is called here, or what we're calling here, atypical, you know, landings or beaching of whales, at least large numbers of them. We've known about that for a long time. We've been observing that. You probably remember as a kid seeing stories about that, or maybe pictures in newspapers or something. I certainly do. Just want to just point out there that it wasn't until 1998 and 96 that it was really known that this stuff was causing these pretty terrible occurrences.
Shocked Pokemon face dot gif. Honestly, I mean, that sounds cynical, but look at the timeline. People knew. The tough thing about being, you know, on the side of science is that you have to have the facts on your side as well. So you have to conduct this research. But to me, it's weird that the scientific community, it was being surprised by that, even though we already knew that sonar in general could cause this stuff. As a matter of fact, honestly, I understand why atypical mass stranding or beaching is a technically correct term, but it is pretty misleading because mass beaching in general should be pretty atypical. I get, like, English is such a tricky language, and we put so many unnecessary things on there, like drug-free school zone. Really? I don't know. That's a different problem for another day, but shouldn't these all be atypical?
I completely agree, and imagine what's happening to that creature. Really, we talked about it earlier on about being, you know, in an environment where something comes along with just the most massive sound that it just, you, there's no way for you to get out and away from this sound because that sound is just traveling wherever you go, and it's permeating the air. No matter, you know, we're thinking about going inside of a house or something or in a structure, but imagine if that sound, if you're on the desert or something, and it's a sound that you can only continue to run in that desert, but it's, the sound isn't leaving. It's just as loud as it was as you're trying to escape it. That's what these creatures are going through in the water, and that's why the beaching occurs, because they're going until they can't go. It's just a tough thing to think about.
Yeah, that's a powerful way to put it. The ocean is one big room without a door to close, and that is terrifying. So here's where we're at, kind of a watershed moment. The lid of Pandora's maritime jar is unscrewed. People know what's happening. Maybe not everybody, but academics know what's happening. Scientists know what's happening. The military certainly is. I strongly suspect the military was much more aware of this much earlier. But it gets, fast forward to year 2000, this issue receives more widespread attention outside of the scientific and environmentalist community when a mass stranding occurs in the Bahamas. Three different types of whales wash up on the beach. It's crazy. The public backlash is huge. Eventually, Uncle Sam says, okay, this might have maybe something to do with a little bit, one aspect of the sonar stuff that we're doing, which is super necessary. And then later they came back and they were like, okay, it was us. Still, this is super necessary stuff to do. It's for the greater good. And now, as we move forward past 2000 and more research is conducted, both on events from 2000 to 2020 and retroactively on previously unexplained events from before then, we see that the list of species whose mass strandings are linked to naval exercises just keeps growing. It's more and more.
Yes, and that includes beaked whales, dwarf whales, pygmy whales, sperm whales, pilot whales, several species of dolphin, and also harbor porpoises. We've seen several mass strandings in the northern Indian Ocean that also coincide with naval tests and exercises involving sonar, and that includes one of the largest ever recorded, 200 to 250 dolphins stranded, beached. That still hasn't really gotten a whole lot of press or attention in the media.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like the whales are going to court. Court is a human invention. A legal system is a human invention. And so humans would have to participate if they wanted to help the whales in a legal sense. We're going to pause for a word from our sponsor and then come back with hopefully some good news on that front. We're back. Dum, 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 dum. Law and Order Maritime. In response to lawsuits brought by multiple environmental groups, the U.S. Navy created a protocol regarding the use of sonar and whales. The basic idea is that before using certain sonar tools or devices, you check to see whether there are animals around that would be affected. And if there are, you can only turn your sonar setting up to X degree, like X level of power, etc. This is not a perfect system because it's pretty much defined as we'll get to it, but it's pretty much defined as what will not permanently damage these creatures.
One of the biggest problems that exists within the technology that the Navy has is their long-range sonar. And it's a thing, it's a tool called Surveillance Towed Array Sensor System Low Frequency Active. Woo! That the woo's not at the end. It's also known as CIRTAS LFA or CIRTAS LFA. And once lowered from the massive reel, which is, okay, you have to imagine this thing being lowered down into the water a bit.
One of those massive spools of like heavy wire.
Mm-hmm. So it's this thing that you lower down into the water, and this system has what they're calling source projectors. There are 18 of them. There are these huge, you can think of them like if you're, I don't know, let's imagine, I'm just thinking about a car maybe with subwoofers in it or something, or if you're in a concert and you see the big speakers that are designed specifically to send out the low frequency stuff. Imagine that there are 18 of those attached to this thing, and they just begin emitting the loudest low frequency tones that you can imagine. And the big problem with all of that is that the frequencies, those, the low ones that they're emanating there, around 100 to 500 hertz, also happen to be the sweet spot, what you'd call the Goldilocks zone, for a lot of marine life. It's not too high, it's not too low, it's right where they want it, and we're just bombarding that frequency level with our stuff.
It's where they communicate, right?
Yes. It's like, if you think with humans, Noel, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the audible human vocal range has a pretty sweet, you know, it's it goes from pretty low to pretty high when you're listening to it.
Like, it's 100 to 120 hertz specifically is where that part of our – that's the frequency range that our voices fill up and that we are able to hear. And that's something we think about when we're producing podcasts is we EQ things, you know, a.k.a. filter out and boost certain frequencies to make things as intelligible as possible on various systems and from far away. So we tend to scoop out a lot of those low frequencies, which can create kind of mud and make it a little harder to understand. But it would be the equivalent of if that sweet spot of 100 to 120 hertz that we need to be able to hear for the human voice to have conversations, something was just generating that frequency at a loud volume to the point where we couldn't hear over it. And it was just clogging up our communications ability. And it was happening constantly, like some form of tinnitus that we all had in our ears at the same time. It would make you go insane. You would become an insane person. It would be chaos, absolute misery.
I would also put it this way. Imagine you don't know where these things are coming from.
Mm.
You have no idea. You know that there are odd things that look like creatures on the surface of the water or under the surface. And you know that they're very loud and they're emitting these things, right? But yeah, to the insanity, if you don't see that stuff or if you don't have another sensory input confirming that, it's almost like you're hearing voices.
Oh, wow. Yeah, or an understanding of like what that is, right? I mean, that's, wow. That's a really rough way to look at it, Ben.
Well, that's why some experts have said, you know, marine mammals perceive the noises from this CERTES LFA thing as a threat, and they react as if it's a threat, understandably. Right now, environmentalists want the Navy to limit what they call explosions in sonar in areas where it's known that marine animals will gather annually at certain parts of the year. We have to point out that these are not sonar activities that are used in acts of war or hot conflicts. The vast majority of these things come about from testing or scenario gaming.
Well, that makes sense. You got to try it out on, you know, a sustained basis or trying different, like you said, like different scenarios. It's interesting too, Ben, because the idea of limiting this and regulating this, it's sort of a philosophical one where you have to like weigh, is it worth killing some whales for the progress of military supremacy? You know, is it worth killing some birds to have cleaner energy? You know, I mean, it's always, you know, weighing these things, but it does feel like with the current administration that we're in, philosophically, protecting wildlife is going to, you know, pale in comparison to, you know, having the best military and the most powerful military on the planet. So, you know, stuff like that, I could see going by the wayside. And to your point, Ben, it already seems to be going by the wayside, right?
I mean, I think that's a very good point, Noel. I would also say that we have to be careful and realize that the U.S. military tends to go about business as usual pretty often, regardless of who is, regardless of which political party is in power. In a lot of ways, that machine continues to run, and it is a philosophical thing. Just to throw in some specifics, in 2007, the U.S. government did publish guidelines for the level of noise for injury to be on the record. They considered impulsive sounds at the level of 230 decibels as the uppermost safe exposure limit for all marine mammals, including beaked whales.
I was just going to jump in here and say, you know, Noel, you were commenting on the current administration when thinking about this, but I would just say these concerns go way beyond any administration when you're thinking about the national security of a country, any country, but specifically the United States, when considering military might versus wildlife conservation. I think we all know where, you know, the status quo that exists within any administration, where the priorities would lie.
You mean getting reelected?
Yeah, well, and Matt, I completely agree with you about, you know, the military being always kind of the priority. And I think when I was referring to the current administration, I was maybe thinking more along the lines of rolling back some environmental controls and care for wildlife, that I feel like that philosophy can bleed even into the military stuff and potentially make it even more of a double downing on stuff like this, just with that attitude in mind. That's, I think, what I was trying to say. But completely agree with you that, you know, this stuff is never going to be as much of a primary concern or even enough in the public eye, as we'll see with some court stuff that we're going to discuss in just a minute.
Right. To quote H.G. Wells from one of his non-plagiarized works, yes, I'm throwing some shade there at him. Like they say in the Island of Dr. Moreau, are we not men? Meaning, does this species not live within a framework of law meant to make, in theory, everything good for the most amount of living things possible? Well, that came to a head on July 15th in 2016, a little bit of victory for the maritime members of the Spaceship Earth, when the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco finally shot down the Navy's pretty self-serving interpretation of something called the National Marine Protections Act. That act is supposed to prohibit any U.S. citizen, agency, or organization from knowingly harming or through negligence harming the creatures we've been talking about, whales, dolphins. It's basically saying, don't club seals, that kind of stuff that I think most people can get on board with, but they had to go to court for it.
Yes, there is a wonderful article about the subject by Alessandra Potenza from The Verge, talking about this very court case, and they found that the sonar used across more than 70% of the oceans in the entire world that we discussed, this low-frequency sonar, was operating under essentially an improper license, permit, whatever. I mean, you know, it sort of seems to me like almost a formality that the military even needs a permit, you know, to contend with these pesky wildlife, you know, organizations that are just trying to, you know, save the whales and all that. Bunch of hippies as far as the generals are concerned. And I am, of course, editorializing here. But the court found that a body of the government called the National Marine Fisheries Service, which was the authorizing, you know, body for these tests, wasn't doing enough to mitigate the harm against marine animals, against this underwater wildlife. There is a law in question here called the Marine Mammal Protection Act. To quote the act itself and the Verge article, is meant to provide for the, quote, least practicable adverse impact on marine animals and their habitats, and that the federal agency in question here, the NMFS, was not acting by the letter of the law in the way that they were overseeing these tests. They gave this kind of blanket license, and then they sort of said, go with God and kill as many whales as you deem fit, Uncle Sam, in service of our great, great country. They didn't really say that, but that's sort of what the outcome was, because it certainly seemed like there was very little oversight in any of this.
And so, in theory, it's good that it got shut down or that they were called to task for it. Many militaries around the world have committed to investigating, and the most diplomatic word would be mitigating their activities to protect marine animals. Because, of course, again, we're at the loggerhead here. We're at we're at what one politician awkwardly called the decision point, and I think in his own autobiography. So do we stop this stuff completely and therefore engage in an enormous trust fall, the like of which humanity has never seen? And the idea being like, hey, let's all just stop trying to spy on each other and kill each other with submarines and the weapons we can carry on board. Probably not going to happen. I'm not a big fan of gambling, but even I wouldn't put money on that. So it takes us to the future. This is where we are at. What do we prioritize? I guarantee you, it is utopian to think that, and I'm using that in the correct sense of the word, it is utopian to think that every nation in the world would agree to even hard limits on sonar going forward. Because if everybody puts those hard limits on and you're the one country that cheats or you know, bends the rules, then you have an immediate and significant advantage. Therefore, it would logically be dumb for you not to do that.
Well, it's the same with, like, you know, if everyone else in the Olympics is using steroids and you're the country that takes a stand against steroids and then you lose, then you look like a sucker. You know, it kind of requires fair play on all sides to level the playing field. And we have no guarantees ever that that's the case. So we have to be as nasty as we think our enemies are being. I don't know. It's a hard thing. How do you act as a good steward of the environment and as a good steward of science, I guess, while also staying on the cutting edge of what everybody else is doing, knowing that you're not always going to be the good guy? And not to say that that's even an impulse in our country, but it's a question that I have, and I wonder, how do you do that?
Or that countries are good.
What if you're not even concerned with your enemies and you're just concerned with your global trading partners? Because there is so much shipping that occurs across the oceans every day with these giant vessels that are terribly loud. And like, we're thinking super tankers, all kinds of different large ships that are carrying the goods that you probably use every day, that I know I use all the time, that get shipped across the oceans.
Yeah, let's not forget the word shipping refers to ships in the sea. I mean, we're not like, you know, you might get some special delivery freight that comes in a plane, but by and large, the way you can carry the largest amount of freight across that long a distance is with massive, massive ships loaded down with shipping containers.
That also remain the most cost-effective method of shipping, which is key here. I'm glad you brought up the commercial aspects, Matt. Those are arguably a little easier to regulate, but in practice, much more difficult because that's another level of global cooperation. I just want to reiterate, going on record, I don't want to miss this point whenever it's brought up. I think there should be two separate Olympics. I think there should be one where everybody signs a waiver. They're allowed to do the drugs and take the enhancements that they want. Does that make me a bad person? Debatably. Am I right? Would it be massively successful? 1,000,000%. I did the math. Sorry.
You remember how happy that statement made Spencer on Harmontown? He said we needed to stop the recording and erase all of that so that you could take that idea and then make it happen.
We could make it happen. The future is now. I mean, let's try not to destroy each other and try not to destroy the whales and the brilliant marine animals. But this is like, I want to see superhumans.
Devil's advocate here, though, guys. Who really cares about whales? Sorry, I'm obviously joking.
Keep it, yeah.
No, I mean, you can see how that could, you know, from the most callous business-minded person, what are the whales contributing to us? What are the whales contributing to the ecosystem? I'm sure there's many things, but again, like you said, there's a lot we don't know about whales. I just could see that conversation happening in a back room and the idea of shutting down the hippie, you know, marine protectionists and how dare they try to stand in the way of our progress and our shipping and our ability to, you know, detect enemy vessels, you know, as efficiently as humanly possible. And unfortunately, that's gonna be a thing. It's hard to change that side. If you can't figure out a way to sell them or to commodify them in some way, the very fact that they're majestic and, you know, rare and beautiful just isn't going to do it for a lot of those types of folks.
I'm just extremely happy that as of now, the whales haven't figured out how to create and wield weaponry, because they would have a pretty good case for revenge against all of humanity. Just putting that out there. We're at least a couple thousand years away from the man-whale wars. So that at least makes me feel safer.
So I had an idea. There's some things we have to cut for time here, but I have a thought experiment, a concept that I wanted to get your thoughts on, and I didn't put it in the notes because I wanted to surprise you, but it's less crazy than it sounds. So the big problem, right, seems to be this dichotomy. Do we risk sacrificing military superiority, aka ultimately human lives, to save whales? Are these two, is saving one hurting the other? That's kind of the gist of the argument. But there is a third way. There are several third ways. One of those would be finding a viable, less harmful alternative to sonar. Sonar was a very easy branch, an easy fruit on a low-hanging branch to grab. I guess something like that. Horticulturists, correct me. But the there's something else we could do. It's one of the reasons I wanted to keep hitting the point that the technology we call sonar already existed in the natural world. What if we made these marine animals valuable to the military as a viable replacement for sonar technology? What if there's a world where beaked whales would do all the things that a sonar device would do? I mean, they're super significant problems with that. First off, that's very close to talking about whale slavery, unless there's some kind of symbiotic relationship we can find. But secondly, governments have already been experimenting with using smaller cetaceans for any number of tasks. So what if there's a world where we can interact with the natural capabilities that already exist? What if we stop building ships and start hiring whales? Bolin 2024.
Are you familiar with the I'm sure you are, Ben, the artist Mobius, French comic book artist?
Yes. Yeah.
Does a lot of surrealist kind of like future scape kind of imagery. He's got some images with like future whales where they're like harnessed with crazy weapons or things like that. And the idea of this whale war is fascinating to me. But definitely recommend people check out Mobius if you're into weird art.
I'm just imagining the Horizon Zero Dawn version of whales where there are these robotic creatures that do kind of what you're talking about, but also serve some other purpose for humanity. Because I am pessimistic that we'd be able to change enough to actually truly save the world's population of cetaceans.
Some are on the rebound, though. A couple of species of whales have been documented to have their population increasing. That stuff's always kind of depressing, though, because it's like, oh, the tiger population in X region more than doubled. What does that mean? Well, now there are three. Like, that's an example I'm just making up. But, I mean, we don't want to sound like we're doing anything other than acknowledging this enormous dilemma. Is there a good answer? I don't really think there is. If one country stops using this, or if one trading company stops using this, the other trading companies are just going to take advantage of that power vacuum. I don't know. Well, I didn't mean this to end on such a down note. I mean, Noel, you're right about Mobius. Those are great comics. I love that guy.
Maybe less future whales than I remembered, but he definitely has some stuff with whales in them. But that is a motif you see a lot, though, like whales flying through the sky, you know, and like with like saddles or something like that, and like lasers. And then there was that thing in Futurama, too. I believe there was a space whale in one of those movies that they put out near the end of the run of that show. But whales or no whales, check out Mobius. The Airtight Garage is a really cool collection. And he collaborated with Alejandro Jodorowsky on a version of Dune that never saw the light of day. There's actually a documentary about that called Jodorowsky's Dune, and Mobius did the conceptual art behind that.
You can also see, I've got some of his tabletop books, or I've got one of them that I would recommend. I think I can't remember if he's the guy who also did this sort of space whale thing, but he is, he did design some of the ideas behind a bunch of films people have seen, including Space Jam and Fifth Element, right? So those are his bona fides, if that's what you were looking for, folks, if you doubted us here.
Space Jam is in fact a stone cold piece of American cinema art.
Garbage.
Sorry. You watch your mouth, sir.
And that's our show. We want to hear from you. What do you think? What is the solution to this intertwined Gordian knot of concerns, problems, and crises? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us as individuals, not just the show. I'm Ben Bolin, HSW on Twitter, and Ben Bolin on Instagram.
If you wish, you may find me on Instagram exclusively, where I am at HowNowNoelBrown.
You can find me at MattFrederick_iHeart, and you can ask me directly, hey, why didn't you talk about air gun arrays in this episode? And I will reply back to you cordially. We ran out of time because there's a lot to talk about on this.
Why are you asking so many questions? Also, why don't you mind your own business? Yeah, you know, let me Google that for you. Sorry, I didn't mean to get aggressive. Okay, I feel better now.
We also have a phone number. If you know, your opprobrium and vim over over air gun array and over the current research we didn't get to just doesn't quite translate into the written word, you can call us directly, where we are 1-833-STDWYTK. Thanks for everyone who sang along as we said that. You've got 3 minutes. It'll go straight to a voicemail. Tell us your story. Tell your fellow listeners. Let us know if you don't want your name or your story on the air. We will respect your wishes. Be aware that one of us might call you back.
Yeah, be very aware because it's about to happen after we finish recording this. I've got a short list already from today. If you don't want to do any of that stuff, you can always send us a good old-fashioned email. Even if we don't get to you or, you know, respond back immediately, know that we are reading your messages. Please know that. We're doing our best to respond whenever possible. Thank you for listening again, and write to us. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.